Today's story of swords, sorcerers, and superheroes is the fantastic voyage of Sinbad the Sailor and the Roc. This version is told by Tony Bradman and Tony Ross. There once lived in the city of Baghdad a young man called Sinbad, whose father was a rich merchant. Sinbad's father died when Sinbad was still a boy, leaving his son plenty of money. But as soon as he was old enough, Sinbad took to wild living, and it wasn't long before he had spent the entire fortune. One morning, Sinbad woke up, his head throbbing after yet another party, and realized he was in trouble. He had no money, and unless he found a way of making some more, he knew he'd probably end up as a beggar on the streets. The answer, he decided, was to become a merchant like his father. So Sinbad sold his house and furniture and scraped enough money together to buy some merchandise. Then he said goodbye to his friends and set sail on a trading ship with a number of other merchants. And to begin with, as the ship sailed from port to port and the merchants traded, things went well. Sinbad soon realized he was sure of making a decent profit on the voyage, and he began to feel happy and confident about his future again. Then one day, as the ship was heading for home, the lookout man caught sight of a small island. The ship needed fresh water, and besides, the sailors and the merchants wanted to stretch their legs on dry land. The captain dropped an anchor, and the crew and passengers went ashore, Sinbad among them. It was a very beautiful place, with fields of exotic flowers, a forest of fruit trees, and a sparkling stream running down from the hills. The sailors and merchants soon spread out over the beach, but Sinbad strolled away from his companions and headed inland. Eventually, he came to a tall tree on the edge of a clearing. He sat down beneath it and, being rather tired, fell asleep. Sinbad woke a few hours later, feeling refreshed and relaxed, and made his way back to the beach, expecting to meet his companions there. But the beach was completely empty. And when Sinbad looked for the ship, all he could see was a small dot slipping over the horizon. They had sailed without him. He could only think that no one had noticed he'd been missing. Whatever the reason, Sinbad was marooned on the island, and everything he possessed in this world, his merchandise and his money, his salvation and the beginning of his new fortune, was simply vanishing before his eyes. Sinbad waited, hoping someone on board the ship would discover the mistake and make the captain return for him. But with every minute that went by, Sinbad knew that such a rescue became less and less likely. After a while, he sank to his knees and wept bitter tears. If he'd thought he was in trouble before, he knew that he was in even bigger trouble now. He wished that he had never left Baghdad. He cursed his evil luck and wondered if he was doomed to end his days alone, far from his homeland and friends. Then he slowly started to pull himself together. "This won't do," he muttered, drying his eyes. "God helps those who help themselves," they say, "and maybe things aren't really as bad as I think they are." Sinbad decided it would probably be a good idea to know more about the island. So he returned to the tall tree and climbed right to the top. There were no signs of people or settlements, the island's interior being almost filled with trees, but there was something in the distance, something strange. Sinbad couldn't be sure, but it looked like a large, perfectly white hill. He climbed down from the tree and set off to investigate. It took him quite some time to reach what he'd seen, and the thick forest prevented any more glimpses of it until he arrived at the spot. Sinbad pushed back the last low-hanging branch and stood transfixed by the amazing sight before him. It was an enormous dome, much bigger than the biggest mosque in Baghdad, its surface smooth and hard as stone to the touch. Sinbad slowly walked round it, but he could discover no entrances or windows anywhere, nor any clue to what this object might be, nor whether it had a purpose. Then suddenly, a dark shadow fell over the dome, and Sinbad too. He looked up at the sky and saw something even more amazing. A bird was descending from the clouds, but this bird was of a colossal size, almost bigger than the city of Baghdad itself, thought Sinbad, let alone its biggest mosque. He realized the bird was heading straight for the White Dome, and he began to panic. Sinbad dived for the cover of the forest undergrowth as the bird landed on the dome. Then he turned to look. The bird brought its enormous wings into the sides and stuck its legs out behind, flattening several trees in the process. It squawked with a noise like thunder, went quiet, and settled comfortably. "Just like a hen brooding on an egg," Sinbad murmured in his hiding place. Suddenly, he remembered a story one of the sailors on the ship had told him about a legendary bird of enormous size, a creature called a roc. Sinbad realized it wasn't legendary after all, it was real, and that the White Dome must be the great beast's egg with a giant baby roc inside. Sinbad stood there thinking for a moment, and a daring plan began to form in his mind. The roc obviously didn't spend all her time sitting on the egg. Sinbad had just seen her returning from a flight to somewhere else. What if he hitched a ride with her the next time she flew away? He had nothing to lose. He was sure that wherever it went had to be better than this island. The sun was setting and the darkness was creeping through the trees. This was as good a time as any, thought Sinbad. The roc probably wouldn't fly off during the night. Sinbad tiptoed out of the undergrowth and made for one of the roc's enormous legs. Then he quickly unwound his turban and, using the material as a rope, he strapped himself to the giant, curved talon. Now all he had to do was wait, although that was easier said than done. He barely slept a wink, of course. His whole being was filled with worry about whether his plan would work or not. What if the roc discovered him in the morning and pecked at him with her terrible giant beak? What if the turban material wasn't strong enough to hold him and he fell from the sky? It seemed to Sinbad that he had just dozed off when he was suddenly jerked awake. The sun had risen, and as he looked down he saw the ground receding rapidly, the giant white egg growing smaller and smaller, and he realized that the roc must have taken flight. He held on to the talon as tightly as he could and prayed that the material of his turban wouldn't tear. Mercifully, it didn't, and after a while Sinbad even began to enjoy his flight through the air. The roc's great wings beat above his head, the wind blew into his face, and far, far below him was the sea glittering in the morning sunshine, its surface dotted with islands. Eventually, the bird crossed a coastline into a landscape of mountains and began to descend. The roc landed at last, jarring every bone in Sinbad's body, but he was alive. He quickly untied his turban before the roc realized he was there, then rolled away across the ground and towards a large boulder nearby. He hid behind it, amazed he had survived such an incredible journey, and, keen to see where he was and what the roc was doing, he took a careful peek out from behind the boulder. Immediately, Sinbad's heart sank. He saw that he was on a steep, rocky hillside with a deep valley below it, the ground brown and barren and littered with boulders and lots of odd-looking shiny pebbles. The valley was surrounded by mountains too, huge, forbidding peaks that looked impossible to climb. It was the kind of place you could easily be trapped in forever. The roc herself was further down the hillside, pecking at something on the ground. Then she raised her head and Sinbad saw that she had a giant snake in her beak, and he realized the roc came here to feed. Sinbad noticed other giant snakes, all of them slithering away from the great bird as fast as they could go. But the roc rose in the air with her wriggling prey and flew off. "Oh no, I don't believe it," Sinbad groaned. He was in an even bigger mess than ever now. "Talk about jumping out of the frying pan and straight into the fire," he muttered to himself. "I should have just stayed on the island. At least there he would have had water to drink and fruit to eat," Sinbad thought, "and the chance that a ship might come." But there was nothing in this godforsaken valley, nothing except the prospect of death, a lingering death from hunger and thirst, or perhaps a fast but very unpleasant end in the belly of a giant snake. Although they all seemed to have vanished now, he noticed. Sinbad slumped to the ground and sat with his back to the boulder, feeling very sorry for himself again. Soon the sun dipped behind the rim of the mountains, and a thick gloom began to steal up from the valley bottom towards him. A sharp wind whipped round the boulder and cut right through his thin clothes. Sinbad rose and stumbled off, looking for somewhere to shelter for the night. He saw the entrance to a small cave and hurried inside, then sat down. Suddenly he heard a quiet hissing, and he turned around as the last rays of the setting sun came through the entrance to the cave and lit its furthest reaches. At the back, curled around her eggs, was one of the giant snakes. Sinbad was so frightened that his hair actually stood on end. The giant snake seemed to be sleeping, but Sinbad was terrified that any movement might wake her. So as the sun disappeared and the cave fell into darkness, Sinbad stayed where he was. He sat there rigid with fear the whole night. It was too much for him. The second the sun rose in the morning and he saw light at the cave mouth, he scrambled to his feet and ran out, trusting that speed would save him. But he had only taken a few steps when a large object whistled past just above his head and landed with a splat in front of him. It rolled down the slope a little way, and Sinbad followed it, curious. But when he saw what it was, he recoiled in disgust, for it was the rotting carcass of a very dead sheep. Then he glanced at it again and realized that a number of those odd-looking shiny pebbles had become stuck in the slimy flesh. And that's when he remembered another story he'd heard on his ship. A sailor had spoken of the legendary Diamond Mountains, a place where a great valley floor was carpeted with diamonds and gems. But they were impossible to get to, so diamond hunters had perfected a cunning scheme. Each morning, the sailor had said, the hunters catapulted dead sheep into the valley, knowing that any diamonds the corpses fell on would stick in the flesh. They also knew that during the day, giant rocks would swoop on the carcasses and carry them off to eat. The hunters simply waited on the peaks of the mountains for the birds to pass by on their way out of the valley, then shot arrows and threw stones to frighten them into dropping their carrion. Then all the hunters had to do was pick the diamonds out of the meat. Sinbad's heart rose. Another plan began to form in his mind. The stones on the ground around him were definitely diamonds, he thought, and he stuffed as many as he could into his pockets. He looked up, and already there was a vast winged shape circling in the sky. He pulled off his turban once more, tied himself to the carcass with it, and rolled it over so that he was underneath. Then he lay there, his face pressed into the foul corpse, and waited. A moment or two later he felt a familiar jerking sensation and knew that the bird had taken the bait. The rock soared high through the air. Sinbad turned his head slightly and glimpsed the mountain peaks below him. Then suddenly he heard noises, shouting, saw arrows and stones whizzing past. And then he heard a very loud squawk and felt the rock release its burden. It was only then that Sinbad realized he had no idea how far he had to fall, and he closed his eyes wondering if he was about to be smashed to a pulp. But, luckily, as he and the dead sheep dropped through the air, the weight of the corpse made it swing right round beneath him. So when they did hit the ground, with an even louder splat, the carcass cushioned the impact. Sinbad hurriedly untied his turban and jumped off the rotting meat. He was covered in blood and slime, but he knew as soon as he looked around him that he was on the far side of the mountains and free of the dreadful valley. Below him was a track that seemed to lead to softer, safer lands. "Who or what are you?" said a voice behind him. Sinbad turned round and saw that he was being watched at a distance by a band of wild-looking men, some carrying bows, some with swords or spears. He realised these must be the diamond hunters and he stepped forward. The men instantly leapt back, obviously scared of his strange sight, and raised their weapons. "Peace be with you," said Sinbad, holding up his hands, palm outwards, to show he meant them no harm. "I am a traveller, and a man just like you." "But how did you come to be tied to our bait like that?" said a hunter. "Ah, that's a long story," said Sinbad, "and one I'm not even sure I believe myself. Still, I'll tell it to you if you help me return to my homeland." The diamond hunters did help Sinbad, and a few months later his friends were astonished when they saw him arrive in Baghdad, especially as he had long been given up for dead. They were even more amazed to hear of his adventures, and delighted for him when he sold the diamonds he had collected in the dreadful valley, restoring his entire fortune, and more, in one stroke. Sinbad bought his old house back and settled down for a while to enjoy a life of luxury. But if his friends thought he would return to his days of wild living, they were wrong. For Sinbad soon grew bored and forgot the fear and discomfort of his voyage, remembering only the amazing things he had seen and the excitement he had felt. So he decided to go travelling again. Some people never learn, do they?